going to be reading from Mark chapter 12 and starting at verse 38 to 44. As he taught, Jesus said, "Watch out for the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and be greeted in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. Such men will be punished most severely." Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but the poor widow came and put two very small copper coins worth only a fraction of a penny. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, "I tell you the truth, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything, all she had to live on."
There are two truths about the Bible and money. Firstly, the Bible has a lot to say about money, more than what most people know. And secondly, most people don't like to hear what the Bible has to say about money. We can't avoid the subject and desperately need to hear what the Bible says, because as we've seen in Mark 10 with the rich young man, our attitude towards money affects our relationship with God and can affect whether or not we inherit eternal life. Clearly, money, like most things, can affect our relationship with Jesus as it competes for our attention and our affection. We're told that we can't serve both God and money. There is a misconception that all churches are only out to get our money. And at some level, I can see why some people think that. I was in a church service in Cape Town that passed the collection around four times. And you consider how certain so-called Christian organizations manipulate people into giving to their cause. Sometimes, tragically, that cause has been filling their own pockets. And you'll be relieved to know that tonight's passage is going to speak out against this kind of abuse. Church isn't supposed to be about money. It's meant to be about Jesus. It's not about the church growing a financial portfolio. It's actually about spending money in order to tell people the great news about Jesus. Money is the servant. Jesus is the master. But whether we like it or not, money is necessary to tell people about Jesus. If not to pay the staff, then to pay for the building, to have a place to meet, to pay for utilities and other running costs. Everything from paper towels to Sunday school craft paper to Bibles. Don't worry, this evening, if you're a visitor, we're not out to fleece you of your money. And you'll notice that we don't take a collection. We're not about the money. And giving to Emmanuel is primarily the task of our members and regulars, those that are committed to our cause, the cause of telling Chippenham and the world about Jesus. Tonight we're in the last part of Mark chapter 12. In Mark 1 to 8, we identified that Jesus is the Christ, God's long-awaited rescuing King. Roughly in Mark 9 and 10, we saw what it looks like to follow this king. And in chapters 11 and 12, we have Jesus arrived in Jerusalem, being challenged by the Jewish religious leaders. But each time Jesus is questioned, Jesus refutes their challenges, and each time proves his authority as God's man, as God's Christ, as God's king. And Mark 12 starts with a parable of judgment against the Jewish leaders specifically and Israel generally for rejecting all of God's prophets and ultimately rejecting Jesus. Jesus then answers three questions, and all his answers point to the fact that we must live all in for God, to love him with all our energy and all we've got. We need to give to God what is God's. We have to give him everything and love him with all we've got, with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And we're to give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. Give Caesar his 2 denarii, but give God everything. And our passage tonight gives us 2 pictures of 2 different responses of living all in for God. Our first picture is in verse 38 to 40. And I suppose a good title would be A Poor Witness. A Poor Witness. Follow from verse 38. As he taught, Jesus said, "Watch out for the teachers of law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and be greeted in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. Such men will be punished most severely." We're still at the temple, and Jesus is still teaching. And Mark has picked out a few highlights from his teaching, and now includes another lesson for us. Jesus has already commended a teacher of the law for his question and answer about the greatest command. But here Jesus is giving a general warning against the teachers of the law. They are the poor witnesses. And they're the poor witnesses because they do exactly the opposite of living all in for God. Mark 12:28 tells us to love God and to love people. That we are to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this: love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. But the teachers of the law do neither. They should have known better and they should have done better. Instead, they put themselves first and take advantage of the needy. They break the first and the second greatest commandments. They break the first to love the Lord your God with everything you've got by loving themselves. They are self-loving and self-promoting. They care only about themselves and they love to be noticed. They distinguish themselves from the rest, from everybody else, by the way they dress. It appears that as teachers of the law, they have what we might call today a uniform. But the thing with a uniform is that you wear it for work, not to be noticed and praised outside of work. It would be like Britain's most successful Olympians, Sir Chris Hoy, Jason Kenney, Sir Bradley Wiggins, and Sir Steve Redgrave, coming and shopping around the centre of Chippenham with their collective 24 Olympic medals around their necks, dressed in their sporting kit. Or perhaps the mayor of Chippenham, Mary Norton, walking around the town centre on unofficial business, having a good giggle there, Caleb, with a mayoral chain around her neck. We'd all smirk and think it just a little bit strange, wouldn't we? Who do they think they are? Just a little bit arrogant and looking for attention. But this is exactly what the teachers of the law were doing. They maneuvered to sit at the most important seats, at the places of honor, at the synagogue and banquets. It would be like wanting to sit at the bridal table, in between the bride and the groom. Look at me, I'm important. It's ugly when we see that, isn't it? Even their prayers are more about themselves than about God. Take a look midway through verse 40. And for a show, make lengthy prayers. See, the problem isn't their prayers, or even that their prayers are long, but that their prayers are for a show. Look at me, look how holy I am. Look how close I am to God. Listen to my beautiful poetic words. I'm better than everybody else. They pray to impress. They pray for the ears of men rather than God's. But I think before we're too harsh on these guys, let's not pretend that sometimes we don't act like the teachers of the law, that we don't do things for show or have little time for people we consider unworthy of our time. I think sometimes we think that we're more important than other people. Sometimes I think even coming to church can be about looking good in front of others, about creating a good impression. We tell our children to sit still and behave so we look like model parents. We sing loudly so others can hear our devotion. We only talk to people that will in some way benefit us. And we smile and we pretend that our marriage is fine. Maybe this is a bit controversial, but it's controversial and prickly because I think it's true. Ladies, there's nothing wrong in looking good. But do you dress up not to so that you can honor God, but rather that the cute guy in church will notice you? Or guys, do you come to church not primarily to grow your relationship with God, but to make an impression on a particular lady? And church becomes us-centered and not God-centered. Our prayers are for show. Do we buy cars or do home improvements like the teachers of the law wear their flowing robes in the marketplace? As a status symbol, so the focus is on us rather than on God. It's just a bit heartbreaking, but the teachers of the law don't just break the greatest command. They demolish the second two. They were meant to love your neighbor as yourself, but they don't. Verse 40 tells us they devour widows' houses. While we can't say exactly what they were doing to devour widows' houses, it's plain to see that what they were doing was wrong. I don't always like using the Greek words, but the Greek word used for devour has the idea of eating until it's finished. Literally, eating the widows out of house and home. Somehow, these teachers of the law were abusing their power and taking advantage of the most vulnerable people of the day, sponging off them and taking advantage. It's like what's being reported on the news so much in recent days, isn't it? People taking advantage of others by abusing their position of power and demanding favors from those usually in a place of need. Like the horrible news coming from Haiti that rescue workers asked for sexual favors before giving aid. Imagine withholding bread from someone. People in dire need, helpless, with nowhere to turn, basically being forced to do horrible things. And it's not just Haiti. It's allegedly rampant in Hollywood, and it's even reported in the walls at Westminster. Taking advantage of the most vulnerable, abusing them. Doesn't that injustice anger you? Doesn't that make your blood boil? How could they? I think it takes a special kind of evil for people in a position of power to rob those that are vulnerable. And that's the equivalent of what the teachers of the law were doing to the widows. It's not the way it should be. Listen to these words from the Apostle John in his first letter. Actually, it'd be good to turn there. John, 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4, verses 19 to 21. So what John says, we love because he, that is God, first loved us. If anyone says, I love God, yet hates his brother, he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen, cannot love God whom he has not seen. And he has given us this command, whoever loves God must also love his brother. Loving God and loving people go hand in hand. You just can't have one without the other. These teachers claim to love God, but they don't love people, so they don't love God. How do we match up to this litmus test? Is our love for God shown in our love for people? I was told once, you only love God as much as you love the person you love the least. You only love God as much as you love the person you love the least. Do we talk to the lonely, awkward guy at work during our short Tuesday morning tea break? The new mom at ETOTS, do we invite her over for tea? Or introduce her to someone who can encourage her and help her, being a young, struggling mum? Are we using our retirement to love those around us? Are we able to love others by driving some of our Leonora sisters to church on a Sunday evening? What a blessing for them, and I bet it would be a blessing for you too. Are you at school? Your teachers need love. Your teachers need to be loved and encouragement too. Being a teacher is hard work. One of the qualifications to be in the 20s home group, it seems, is to be a teacher. These guys work really, really hard. And I think just a little thank you could make a world of difference to them. Some of them might have never had anyone ever thank them before. It's loving would make a difference. Don't follow the poor witness of the teachers of the law. Mark wants us to follow the faithful witness of the poor widow. The poor widow. This widow that Mark speaks about, along with the woman in Mark chapter 14, have been immortalized wherever the gospel is preached. In both cases, the woman gave what they could to honor the Lord. One gift, the gift from the woman in Mark chapter 14, was actually a large and costly gift. She anointed Jesus' head with costly perfume. The other, the widow from our passage, gave a small and almost worthless gift. Yet in both cases, it's not so much what they gave, but why they gave. In both cases, it was a costly gift, giving everything, of being all in. In the past, I've had to give a lot of lifts to folk to and from Heathrow Airport. And I drive a little bit early on purpose, because I love sitting in airports and just watching people, all the strange and interesting people that are walking past. Not only do you see some really odd people, but you often get to see wonderful emotion as friends and family are reunited. And you can't tell what their backstory is, but you can tell that they're really happy to see one another. Some people hustle and bustle, moving quickly from one point to the other. They know exactly where they're going and what they're doing. Packing light, you know they're businessmen, and off they go. Others come in from arrivals, and clearly they're tourists or first-timers. You can see they just don't have a clue and don't know where they need to go to next. Young and old, rich and poor, male and female, weird, very weird, and normal, different nationalities and different cultures. Sometimes it's just interesting watching them come and go. Jesus here takes a break from teaching. He sits down and he watches people as they put money into the temple treasury. Read with me from verse 41. Jesus sat down opposite the place where they were, where their offerings were put, and watched the crowd put their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two very small copper coins, worth only a fraction of a penny. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, "I tell you the truth. This poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They gave out of their wealth, but she out of her poverty put in everything, all she had to live on." As he's seated opposite the collection point, Jesus sees a great variety of people giving to the temple treasury. There would have been all manner of varieties, but Jesus chooses to comment on one poor widow. There's lots of creative guesses as to how Jesus knew how much they were putting in. Some suggest it could have been the sound the coins made as the coins were tossed into the receptacle, landing into the chest. It could have been that the temple priest receiving the offerings was calling out the amount as it was received and counted. But the text doesn't tell us. But it does tell us that Jesus knew exactly what was being given. It makes sense too. I mean, he's God. Why shouldn't he know supernaturally what each person was giving? Surely the God that knows all things, who doesn't need to be taught anything, can know exactly what was being given without seeing firsthand. Jesus knows that the rich are giving great amounts. Let me tell you, people needed to give great amounts because running the temple was a costly business. But they give from a religious motive, just going through the motions rather than as worship. Jesus knows this poor widow gives two very small copper coins, each only worth about 1/64 of a day's wage. Jesus sees what's going on and sees a teaching opportunity. And so he calls his disciples over and teaches them. I tell you the truth, Jesus says in verse 43. This poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They gave out of their wealth. But she, out of her poverty, put in everything, all she had to live on. I'm going to generalize a little bit, which is always dangerous, isn't it? But who is it that usually has a building or a room named after them? What is the usual criteria for this honor? I think, or is it usually how much they put God first? Or is it the size of their financial contribution to the project? Maybe in Christian circles, it's the one who was a model and lived for God. But I think most times, it's actually the financial contribution that matters. Give a lot of money, you can have a building named after you, or a room. And after all, building projects can't be completed on just copper coins. We intentionally or unintentionally honor the one with the deepest pockets, the one who gives the most. But Jesus looks at the situation totally differently, and he cuts right to the heart of the matter, because he doesn't place value on how much is given, but rather how much is left. Take a look at verse 44. They gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything, all she had to live on. Jesus doesn't teach the disciples and say that she gave him two copper coins, even though he knew that's what she gave, but that she put in everything, all she had to live on. She had nothing left. She gave 100% of what she had. Now, we're all able to give different amounts, and the point here is that we should give as much as we can. I reckon the Old Testament tithe of 10% is probably a good starting point, but it's also a poor finishing point, because we're to give as much as we can. We're to give that it hurts. We're to give so that we feel it. And it's only sacrificial giving if it hurts just a bit. Does it mean you need to watch what you spend elsewhere to get through the month? Yes. Does it mean you need to go hungry? I don't think so. But it has to hurt. After we become a Christian, there are two things which take just a little bit longer to change in our hearts. That's our watch and our wallet. We're changed and we're living our best for Jesus, but our watches and our wallets take just a little bit longer. Our watch still determines what we prioritize. And the things we prioritize are the things that are important to us. It's strange how we always have time for the things we prioritize. And church-related God things get sidelined. I missed church because I had to finish my homework. I didn't do my quiet time because work is crazy. I missed a prayer meeting because I wanted to get an early night. I missed home group so I could see an old friend. I wish I could say I haven't made those excuses myself. But when you say them out loud, they sound just a little bit lame. Our wallets are even further behind. We give as little as we can, but seldom as much as we can. What can I get away with? What's the least I can get away with? What's the least I can give? Our wallets indicate our first love. What is it that we spend the most on? Where your treasure is, there our heart will be also. What does your wallet tell you about how much we love God? I know an accountant in Cape Town who says she can read numbers like a narrative. She's a bookkeeper for various businesses and says she can tell so much of what's going on in a business, what relationships are like, just by looking at the balance sheet. I can't share the details, but she knew in one organization that there was a personality clash between two of its top leaders before it even became public knowledge. She knew that just by looking at the finances. It wasn't long afterwards that one of them was fired. With us, our narrative is much, much more obvious. The story our finances tell us will make it clear where our hearts are. What does our monthly spending tell us about how much we love God? Not just how much we're spending, but our monthly budget. Our higher priority is giving to the Lord's work. Is it the first thing that goes in your budget? Or is it the bit that you give at the end? Do you try and work out your 10% before your mortgage or after your mortgage? After you've paid your car? I'm not saying we should give unwisely. Please don't hear me saying that. What I'm saying is what I think the text is saying, that we need to give as much as we can in total trust, radical reliance, and utter commitment in God. Jesus has already told us that it all belongs to God anyway. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's. I'm also not saying that it's easy. We know from the rich young man in Mark chapter 10 that it's hard. He loved his money more than God and was unwilling to give it up. I'm also not saying that we must give everything we have and then God will bless us and give us more. So we give our salary and we expect to get it back with a little bit of interest. That's just like trying to twist God's arm, trying to manipulate him. And that's miles from real trust, isn't it? But the issue is, are we willing to give even if we won't get in return? We don't know how the poor widow in our passage survived over the next few days, if she's given all she had. I'd like to think that God provided for her, but we don't know. What we do know is that her heart was in the right place, and that loving God was more important than her next meal. She was all in. Loving God with everything we've got means being all in. Half in on our terms doesn't work. While we were praying before the service, it's a good thing to do on a Sunday evening. Come and pray at 6 o'clock before the service. But while we were praying, I thought of a really good, well, I think a good illustration of this. You know what it's like when you're given a jug full of water and you're having to pour drinks with it. and you get a jug that's just slightly wonky, and as you're pouring, water just goes absolutely everywhere. And you kind of do it slowly. You know the best thing to do? Just take the jug and whoop, throw it really quickly. Do it really quickly, and you're going to get less mess. If you go all in and just throw it in, you'll have less mess. But if you sit and you struggle and try and balance the things, you're just going to have more mess. We've got to be all in our relationship with God. Mark's gospel says we've got to be all in. We've got to be all in before our family, before wealth, and before ourselves. In the passage before this, we see that Jesus is worth it because he's more than just the son of David. He's the son of God. And I think finding something worth living for is easy. But all in means finding something worth dying for. And our question is what we're living for worth dying for? Jesus thought we were worth dying for. But not because we're amazing, but because he is amazing. We have to be all in for Jesus. To love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, and with all our strength. We've got to be all in for Jesus.